Good morning, everybody.
Want to be closer? You got it. Okay, is that better? Are you better now, everyone? I'll try to project. Still can't hear me. Okay. How was that? Did that work? Fantastic. Okay, it's a privilege to be learning with you this morning. I'm always inspired to walk into Beis Medrash and see committed women who are excited to dedicate their time, whatever free time they have, even if it's Sunday morning, to learning Torah. And I thank you all for doing that and for the invitation to come and share with you a little bit. This morning, the thoughts that I put together are things that I think about frequently as a parent and as an educator, but especially so recently, and especially in response to a very heartrending question that was posed to Rabbi Nid Henkin Erev Simchat Torah. How is it that we walk into Yontif and hold on to our Sifrei Torah after the horrific murders of her son and daughter-in-law? What does it mean that Torah expects of us to exhibit a simcha under those circumstances, and by extension, consistently, at different points within our religious experience, when emotions are hard to call forth? What does it mean that there is an element of simcha that's obligatory? I'm holding on to this mic as though it exists. And certainly, as we think about the value of happiness within our lives, you appreciate it from so many different angles and dimensions. I can't tell you how many times I'll talk to parents, or so I'm talking with my husband, and the line that slips out is, I just want my kids to be happy, right? Or if you consider it even academically or historically, what does it mean as American citizens that our inalienable rights, right, written in the Declaration of Independence, are articulated as life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? Life and liberty certainly resonates, and the pursuit of happiness, what does that actually mean? There have been tremendous analyses and degrees of scholarship done on that question itself. But in that triad, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it certainly articulates a fundamental value, right? Just as you would want your life to be protected, you want your, sometimes it's property, pursuit of happiness is perceived to be property, your freedom and your personal possessions or your personal pursuit of your own destiny. So from an American Constitution perspective, it's a very personal right. It's inalienable. It's part of your human being. Interestingly, in the last parsha, in Parshas Noach, we read about the earth being full of Hamas, right? And that, at least in the text itself, was the reason Hashem gives for why we needed to start over, right? And Ibn Ezra and Rashi both say that what's Hamas? Hamas is thievery, robbery. Why would that single crime be pulled out of all? Clearly society was in disarray. It wasn't just about robbery. But both Rashi and Ibn Ezra articulate that robbery is an existential assault on a person's ability to pursue their own destiny. I take what is yours because you don't even matter. Because only I matter. It's the extreme nihilistic egotism that a person looks at the world and says, it's just me. And so it's not just that I'm taking your property, I'm taking your entire existence, because you don't even exist in my perspective. And that was deserving of a do-over. So that takes, let's say, the American concept, perhaps a very individualistic, You have a right to whatever your pursuit of happiness is, which we appreciate has complications because it happens in all of societal arguments and even in legal arguments. What right does any government or any citizen have to limit someone else's definition of what their happiness is? Right? It's my pursuit of happiness. As an individual, it's guaranteed to me. It's inalienable. Does it have any societal impact? Perhaps. But unless I'm hurting you, you don't have a right to limit mine. Right? So at least even from a very basic level, the American Constitution guarantees us happiness as an individual. Perhaps Torah pushes us to consider it from a different perspective, and I think that's hinted at by the descriptions of Rashi and Ibn Ezra, that it wasn't okay for the world to continue to grow along this very individualistic, nihilistic approach. If you want to look at the value of happiness from perhaps a more intellectual, philosophical perspective, its ancient roots are found in Greek philosophy, and it's called eudaimonia, Aristotle and the Nicomachean Ethics. Argues that all of human existence is the search for the summa bonum, the greatest good. Obviously, all of valuable human existence. There's lots of invaluable human existence, but from a philosophical angle, what we're aiming for is this greatest good. What is the thing that we are all here for? What value do we assert to the things that we do? And he looks and he argues for all different definitions of it. And the number one, he says, that which is always desirable in and of itself and never for the sake of something else, so that it has an internal intrinsic value. And for that, he would talk about honesty. Honesty is a part of the pursuit of perfection, of the pursuit of the greatest good. And that happiness that man receives from being honest is not because someone else then trusts him, but because he's being true to his own self, and he's being true to his own identity. I pulled out a few quotes for us to look at how Aristotle and the other classic Greek philosophers would argue that we are all searching for this greatest good, for this level of happiness. So the second one would be, for it is not one swallow or one fine day that makes a spring, so it is not one day or a short time that makes a man blessed and happy. In other words, the longest journey is towards which goal? Recognizing blessings and happiness, right? It's another formulation of the value that happiness really does hold in our aspirations. And the last source that I brought you is, the function of man is to live a certain kind of life. And this activity implies a rational principle, that which we do makes sense. And the function of good man is the good and noble performance of these actions that are based on rational principle. And if any action is well performed, it is performed in accord with the appropriate excellence to the highest level. If this is the case, then happiness turns out to be an activity of the soul in accordance with virtue, right? And virtue, for Aristotle, is a rational element. It is the idea that it only produces good. It is the idea that you do it for no ulterior motive, as mentioned in the beginning, and that you don't need any external feedback, so to speak, to tell you that it's right. It's obvious from the get-go. And again, honesty is his biggest example for that. So that's the Greek ethic, perhaps, of what it means to be pursuing happiness. It's some type of ideal existence that is always looking for how do I perfect my complete honesty, my selflessness, right? And yet, when we look at these quotes, and I chose them because I think they're representative, it doesn't seem to involve very much interaction. It doesn't seem to involve anybody else, per se. You might be able to achieve this level of perfection and happiness as a hermit on the top of a mountain somewhere. As you sat and you contemplated and you meditated and you adjusted and you worked on your character, you don't necessarily need anybody else. Okay? And so I think that's a very interesting thing. noting and without doing any of the research to connect, that perhaps the Western canon and the definition of happiness has a lot to do with individualism and a lot to do with individual perfection. Okay? Not ignoring the fact that certainly Western civilizations are invested in the creation of a civilization, but the core of it is built on the growth and the perfection of the individual. I think when we look at what Torah tells us, in its formulation of Simcha, we're going to find something radically different. And more so, it isn't just an ephemeral, emotional experience. As you'd expect, most of halachic life is practical, directed toward action, and implies the ability to connect you to HaKadosh Baruch Hu through those actions. And Simcha is no different. Certainly, many people from the outside and the inside of Torah Judaism might put a claim to us and say that all of this halachic life is a lot of hocus pocus, right? Wrap it this way, wash your hands, two hands, it's like monkey see, monkey do, turn around, touch the ground, magic, poof, now you're a spiritual person. It doesn't seem so obvious to people looking from the outside that there is an emotive or a spiritual level of observance. You might be on the defensive to claim that halacha actually requires an internal life. We're so regulated. We are so mandated, right? Hours, minutes. Where's the internal life? And that's a claim that's been put to Judaism for a very long time. It's not a claim that we have a hard time answering. And therefore, I think, though, it's a claim we have the responsibility to build an appreciation in our own lives, to dedicate time to help us understand that even as we do our checklists, we're remembering that on that checklist is an internal life and an appreciation of motive experience as well. So from the very basic and fundamental value, we look to the Gemara where it says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Liba Ba'i. Hashem is not only asking us to move our hands, right, and to perform mitzvot. But there is an expectation that our hearts are involved. It's very important to know that in the time of the Gemara's writing, and even through the medieval period, the heart was considered the location of the intellect, not the brain. So when you see Liba, it's not necessarily Hallmark, right? It's not just like the hearts of Valentines. It's your intellect and your understanding. Those are unified. They're not separate as like the heart and the mind is later in Western civilization. So Hashem expects an internal life is really what this means, not just an external performance. The Rav was very expressive about what that internal life could look like. Not so much what it should look like. Right? But how the Rav expressed his own experiences and his own aspirations. And I think even, I don't mind sharing personally, as a young modern Orthodox woman who wasn't sure, how do you cultivate this internal life? There's a lot of learning that goes on, right? And there's a lot of performance that goes on. How do you then allow for that experience to develop internally? I found the Rav's art of the Rav's essay of The Lonely Man of Faith incredibly encouraging. Because here you have a Torah giant, a philosophic giant, who admitted and articulated the challenge of faith, of doubt, of loneliness, of worry, right, of aspiring and not always achieving, as a part and a valued, validated part of Avodas Hashem. Not that it was a failing, but that's what it means to be an Eved. So in that kind of experience, the Rav almost like embraces all religious stages and says, this is part of your learning and your building your connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In the essay of Catharsis, the Rav says very, very clearly that no person should ever say, as a human animal, I simply don't have control over my emotions, right? It's just what I'm going through. I'm in a bad mood, right? And I don't have the capacity to channel that or control it. The Rav is very clear that just as we are charged to be in control of our ideas, we have to cultivate them, we have to correct them, we have the responsibility to be informed. We have the same responsibility to control our actions, and our emotions are within the domain of human perfection. Okay, the halacha thinks there is an ethic, not only of action, but of feeling as well. Man is master of his own emotional world, capable of disowning feelings or emotions, however compulsive or powerful. If they seem to be disruptive, and conversely, of assimilating redemptive emotions into his personality. Certainly, there's nature. Certainly, there are circumstances that are provocative of sorts, right? The Rav would never, this is not anti-psychology. This is simply empowering us to not take this part of our experience of life and say we don't have control of it. We know it in some regards, right? I think just as there's a parent or a teenager who's gone through any emotionally difficult circumstance that doesn't realize that they have some control over it. But to put it into the realm of halacha is an entirely different thing. To say that HaKadosh Baruch Hu in our halachic prescriptions is expecting us to also, right, have that internal life as a part of our fulfillment of certain mitzvot is a very important obligation, doesn't have the same how-to. How do I set a Shabbos clock? I know. How do I have Havana? I'm not so sure. How do I experience a Simcha Shel Mitzvah? It's not as clear, right? So I think the how-to here is very difficult, but the certain expectation is very important for us to own. To understand that the expectation of that mitzvot require an emotional mastery or a training plan, right? I think sometimes some of the big ones we ignore. No one's ignoring the challenge of kavana and tefillah, but the big ones are really hard, right? So v'yahavta et Hashem Elokecha, loving God, right? To love the people I have to interact with all the time. That I have to figure that out, right? That one I have. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu, like, I have to love him, but, you know, I don't really have to figure it out by Tuesday morning, right? So I don't have the same pressing needs for V'yahavta Hashem Elokecha. But there's no question, it's Pasha Pshat, that is an expectation of our total package, right? Whether it happens in short order, whether it happens in one performance or not, and certainly the Rambam gives an entire section of his Mishneh Torah to talking about how you build Avat Hashem through, again, similar to what I described to you before, the heart is thought of as the place of the thoughts and the mind. We build our Ava by understanding, just like you want to get to know somebody that you want to love, right? And the more you get to know them, the more you love them. Avat Hashem, according to the Rambam, it's a program of really Yediat Hashem. Learning Torah is an expression of Avat Hashem. Your halachic performance is an expression of Avat Hashem. But we know the challenge here really is what we said before. All of those things that could lead you to Avat Hashem could also not lead you to Avat Hashem. Because you could just, performance-wise, do the mitzvot without trying to dig down to the secondary level. You can get through Shas. You could learn it, but not uncover a deeper relationship. And so because there is in certain mitzvot, and Avat Hashem is one of them, because there are in certain mitzvot dual layers of fulfilling the halachic obligation, you might ignore the secondary one. And that's why it's so important to spend the extra time and recognize that ultimately that's really connected to our Torah-oriented summa bonum. What is it that we're ultimately after? It's not just the checklist of performance. Okay, I think that this emotive mitzvah of lo tisna et achicha bilvavecha probably does have a little more pressing needs, right? We can't exactly ignore that emotional experience. If in fact you are having a hateful relationship with somebody, everyone sees its negative, destructive forces, and therefore you either deal with it positively or you have to face the difficulty of living with that. So I don't think that that's something that we have to worry about facing, but I think those sources are in the extreme, recognizing that the Pashat Pshat, Halacha D'Oraisa, emotions are an important part of our Avodas Hashem. Right? So that claim of who has control, and maybe it's just therapeutic, and it's developmental, and etc., which we see is important part of Western psychology, it is an important part of it, but you simply cannot look through a halachic corpus of expectations and say Hashem is only invested in our performance, in our avoda, is invested in our internals as well. So what's interesting is the how. How do we cultivate control over our emotions? And then we'll go to what does this have to do with simcha. There are two different approaches that I brought to you. One comes from the lo tachmod mitzvah. You shouldn't covet. You shouldn't want. So the Ibn Ezra there posits that how do you control a natural desire, right? How do you do that? He argues that it is simply an intellectual exercise. Okay, so if you look at it, he says, I'll offer you a mashal. If a peasant who's of a sound mind, he's not an idiot, right? So a peasant comes and sees a beautiful princess, he's not going to desire that beautiful princess because he knows, right? His mind is all together that it's just not going to happen, right? So for Ibn Ezra, that type of jealousy, that type of coveting, it's an intellectual thing. You need to sharpen your mind and recognize. So similarly, he would say, if a person knows that Hashem tells us that we're not allowed to X, Y, and Z, you build your prowess, your defenses against these emotions by building your understanding of the origin. All of these halachot, they come from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You can control your emotional response to it. That's the Ibn Ezra's approach. It's a very intellectual approach. The Sefer HaChinuch, which is interesting, I wish we knew more about who wrote the Sefer HaChinuch. It's an anonymous text put together in the 13th century. The Sefer HaChinuch tells us something else. For the Sefer HaChinuch, it's not intellectual. You don't have to argue your way around it. For the Sefer HaChinuch, you control jealousy really by sheer force of will. So let's read what he offers us. Don't wonder how it is that one has a power to restrain his heart from longing for riches that he may see in his fellow man's possession, when he himself is lacking them all. How can a prohibition be given in the Torah about something which man cannot possibly obey? So Sefer HaChinuch says that's not something to worry about. Only like fools would say something like that, even worse than fools. It's not just intelligence, it's also a sense of rishus here. You're like not on the right track. Because a person can really control themselves. He controls his thoughts and his longings from whatever he wishes. It lies within his free choice, his decision to repel his desire or to draw near to it. He puts it all into the area of willpower, right? You might connect this to the classic cases of where it is that even the Rambam says, it's natural to want. It's natural to want basar v'chalav. It's natural to want licentious sexual relationships. Those are all natural. And then what do you have to say? You just say, but I'm not allowed to. Interestingly, in that formulation, it says because HaKadosh Baruch Hu said so. Here, it's more just your self-control. Any kind of self-control would be valuable. So this orientation brings us to the fact that there are like three classic divisions of mitzvot. It was first formulated, any of these divisions of mitzvot, not that, whenever you say three classic divisions, people think of asay, right, and lo tasay, okay, and then maybe something of a hybrid fashion where both of them exist, right, there are some mitzvot that have both, or ben adam l'chaveiro, ben adam l'makom, Bein Adam La'atzmo, that's another one, right? The division I was thinking about that relates to this topic more closely is an early 11th century division that was written first by Vachi ibn Pakuda, and it was Chovot HaLevavot, Chovot HaEvarim, right? And then, if we want to add on to it, take a massive jump in history, I think the Rambam refers to it, but not as explicitly, that there's a third category which combines the two layers, and the Rav is the first to really articulate that there is something called a mitzvah, where there's a ma'aseh mitzvah and there's a kiyum mitzvah. There's two levels. Chovot halevavot is clearly the mitzvah of the heart. But you have to have Hashem Elokecha. That's a chovot halevavot. You have to, right? Lo tisana, you shouldn't hate. That's chovot halevavot. Chovot ha'evarim is v'lakachta lechem the arbaminim. You have to take it. You do your karbanos. There's a question whether a kavana is required or not required sometimes, but there are mitzvot that are just physical mitzvot. They could help cultivate a good personality. They could build our avodas Hashem and our appreciation of the world and others around us, but you fulfill it regardless. The Rambam in Hilchot Tzedakah, Hilchot Matznot Aniyim, makes the case that tzedakah is an example where you have to have both, which is fascinating, because you would think that tzedakah could simply be transactional, right? Like I, by virtue of transferring money to a poor person or someone in need, I've achieved a tremendous good. Why does it matter what was in my head? So if I'm walking down the street and I have a hole in my pocket and $50 falls out and a poor person picks it up, I should get credit. Right, that person's life has changed as a result of me. For the Rambam, that's not the case. For the Rambam, tzedakah is exactly one of these third categories, where you have a ma'aseh mitzvah and you have a kiyum ha-mitzvah. The act of the mitzvah was done when the money transfers, right? But the kiyum of the mitzvah, the fulfillment of the mitzvah, was not complete. So that mitzvah is an incomplete mitzvah. Unless a person... The Rambam is so explicit. I should have brought you this source. It's Perek Yod, I think it's Halacha Vav, somewhere between Gimel and Vav. The Rambam says, not only do you have to look at the person and mifasehu bidvarav, and comfort him, almost like saying, hello, how are you, hope you have a good day, right? And in that process, give him money. That if you don't have any money on you, and you just do that, you're still fulfilling the mitzvah of tzedakah. That's how far the Rambam goes. Because his expectation is that the kiyum ha-mitzvah and the ma'aseh ha-mitzvah in tzedakah isn't about monetary transaction, it's about caring about somebody else and helping, giving them from what you have, whatever it is. Whether you have money, food, or words of comfort. And the Rambam's really particular on that. So the Rav creates this third category of mitzvot that require both your evarim and your lev. And for our purposes, I thought it would be really helpful to look at one of these overarching mitzvot, simcha, that is an expression of this third category, that requires both action and some type of internal experience as well. And certainly the value of simcha has been popularized by the song and by the from the pasuk in Tehillim, Ivdu es Hashem b'simcha. What's interesting there is, also from the Ibn Ezra, he says the combination of Ivdu es Hashem b'simcha, avoda together with simcha, is noteworthy because kol ha'oved, kol ha'oved yit'atzev, is his lashon. Usually, people who are burdened by service to somebody or something else have a sense of yit'atzev, could be sadness, maybe it's just being burdened, obligated, right? But besimcha means we have to elevate it. Our avoda needs to therefore also be besimcha. Avoda, typically, halachically, what does avoda always refer to? The karbanos or tefillah, right? That's the way avodah shebalev. So that's one possibility. But we see that when it comes to the expression of simcha in all Chamishei Chumshei Torah, it was something that I learned from Rabbi Jonathan Sachs, says that simcha is only mentioned in Bereishis, Shmos, Vayikra, and Bamidbar once in each sefer, whereas in Devarim it's mentioned 12 times. And which other sefer in all of Tanakh is simcha mentioned multiple times? More than any other, the most unlikely, Koheles. So there's something in that that I think is really relevant, and I want to use that as a frame for appreciating what it is that the mitzvah of simcha is expecting of us. So we'll start in Devarim. Moshe, we know in Devarim, has the opportunity to review and highlight a roadmap for Bnei Israel. They're about to go in to Eretz Israel, and Eretz Israel is, frankly, the communal fulfillment of everything else, right? That which he won't participate in, and yet it is the fulfillment of Avram's journey. It's the fulfillment of all of the avos. It's the fulfillment of Bnei Israel coming out of Mitzrayim. It is the fulfillment of all mitzvot. According to the Ramban, all mitzvot outside of Eretz Israel are just preparatory, just getting us ready for the real deal, which is in Eretz Israel. So the fact that Moshe in Sefer Devarim implements his instructions to Bnei Israel with Simcha as a cornerstone is very significant. And these two psukim, the first two that I brought to you, obviously they're out of order chronologically, but I brought them to you because they represent flip sides of one coin. Moshe is telling Bnei Israel, "V'samachta b'chol atov asher nasan lach Hashem Elokecha ulevezcha atah v'halevi v'ager asher b'sharecha b'kirbecha." I'm sorry. The Rambam says, when you get to Eretz Israel, in this context, it is about the Bikurim, "V'samachta b'chol atov asher nasan lach Hashem." That's where you must experience and must express your simcha for everything that Hashem's given to you. And the flip side of it is, if you don't, you will be punished. Why? Tachas asher lo avadet Hashem Elokecha b'simcha b'tuv levav. The Moshe is telling us that achieving the fullness of the bracha in Eretz Israel requires simcha, and in the absence of simcha, you could do all the actions, but it will not be sufficient. Tachas asher lo avadet Hashem Elokecha b'simcha u'b'tuv levav mirov kol. There is definitely something in here about gratitude, right? The bracha that's been given to you needs to be fully articulated and appreciated. The flip side of all those brachot is that without simcha, it isn't complete. So Rabbi Jonathan Sachs also asks us to consider another expression of simcha, perhaps that's more aligned with gratitude. And the language there is not sin mem chet. The language there is ashreinu matov chalkenu, right? And that lashon of ashrei, of gratitude, of how fortunate are we for everything that we've been given, we see much more frequently in Tehillim than we do in Tanakh. Okay? And he contrasts that. Tehillim is, what's Tehillim versus Tanakh? So many possible answers to that question. Tehillim is the meditations of an individual. And we often communally express them because we try to give each other chizuk in that, in those moments. But they're written that way. It's a person crying out to Hashem. And so Ashreichem Matov is like the solace that we offer to individuals, right? But Tanakh is your communal guidelines. Right? There's no question about it. And you'll see the contrast in a little bit more. But Rabbi Sachs would say that Ashrei, the Lashon of Ashrei Ha'ish, Asher Lo Halach, the Lashon of Ashrei in all sources in Tehillim is much more of an individual experience, whereas Simcha, the premise of what we'll see in these sources, is a communal experience. And that's why Moshe highlights Simcha and Sefer Devarim as they're coming to the apex of their communal journey. Considering that we're right now, right after Sukkot, I thought it would be valuable to note that Sukkahs of there are other mitzvot that are also articulated as simcha related, and we'll talk about that. Yom Tov and Sukkot are two of the highlights. But because it's given the titles Zman Simchateinu, I thought it would be valuable to look at the specifics of Sukkot, or the mitzvot of Sukkot, and what Simcha has to do with them. So the first is to look at in Zvarim, V'samachta b'chagecha atu v'incha v'itacha v'avdecha v'amascha v'alevi v'ager v'hayatom v'almana asher b'sharecha. This expression of the requirement of Simcha on Yom Tov is... provokes us to ask, if that's the requirement of all Yom Tovim, why would Sukkot be given that special title, Zman Simchateinu? Right? Why not just have all Yom Tovim be Zman Simchateinu? Why Sukkot especially? The proposal that's offered is that, what are the two mitzvot? What are the obligatory mitzvot of Sukkot? Two obligatory mitzvot. We have Sukkah and we have Arba Minim. Right? Sukkah is, without all of the details, it's about taking us into a temporary, insecure dwelling and recognizing our dependence on HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? In one fashion, right? In our security. Perhaps in nature as well, but primarily in our dwelling. The fact that we as Bnei Yisrael are always on a journey, we are always vulnerable, and it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's protection, whether it's Anane HaKavod or in the Midbar, whatever it is, it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's protection that we rely on. What's the root value that's expressed in the Arba Minim? It's our dependence on HaKadosh Baruch Hu through nature. Each of the various Minim represent the brachot and the blessings that we get also from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. One is about nature and one is about history. And both together are about Israel's dependence on HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What happens differently on Sukkot than on other Chagim, other Yom Tovim that also have an obligation of Simcha? The Samachta B'Chagecha is shared for all Yom Tovim. But what's different about Sukkot? We are out there with our Lulav and Esrog, with our Sukkot, And in Aliyah LeRegel, and mitzvah, the mitzvah of Karbanos is shared also with the Shivim Amimim, with 70 other nations, right? So this dependence is a proclamation. It's a very obvious, very public proclamation. It is not a private experience. It is not particularistic. It's not limited to just a message to Bnei Israel about their own experiences. It's a public, universal declaration that God is in charge of nature and of history. It's pretty much as global as you can get. And it has its expression in the Karbanos that we invite all the nations of the world to give on Sukkot. What does that have to do with Simcha? I think we have to look at the underpinnings of Simcha Shel Yom Tov and Simcha Shel Mitzvah before we can answer that question. So I'm going to skip down to source 14, where you have the Rambam's expression of Simchas Yom Tov. Hilchos Yom Tov comes after Hilchos Shabbos. So Hilchos Shabbos already has expressed the halachot of how we fulfill Shabbos, and it's interesting to know this notion of Simcha Shel Mitzvah on Shabbos is limited to Oneg Shabbos, right? To enjoying Shabbos. It is not one of those mitzvot that has a kiyum and a masa, right? You can have Oneg Shabbos by having a hot potato kugel, and you're fulfilled whether or not you're thinking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu's creation of the world, okay? But Simchas Yom Tov seems to have another layer, okay? And the Rambam reflects this here. Kishem shemitzvah slachabed Shabbos vil ango kach kol yamim tovim. So Shabbos has kibud and oneg, right? Kavod Shabbos comes in the form of all the ases and lo tases. Oneg Shabbos comes in the form of all of the adornments that we do, and rest, and all of those other things, right? So he says the same two mitzvot Oneg and Kavod apply to the Yomim Tovim as well. Lekadesh Hashem mechubad v'chol Yomim Tovim ne'emar b'hem mikra kodesh u'kvar bi'arnu ha'ibud v'ha'inug b'hilchot Shabbat. V'chein ra'ui la'adam shelo yis'od be'erev b'yamim tovim. Sorry, the spacing here is off. Min ha'mincha v'lamala ke'erev Shabbos. So the same way that you're supposed to enjoy your Friday night meal and you shouldn't eat close to Erev Shabbos or close to lighting candles so that you can really appreciate that hot potato kugel, the same thing applies to Yom Tov. The same way we had described Oneg and Kavod for Shabbos, it applies for Yom Tov as well. V'chol mevaze et hamoadot ki'ilu nitapel la'avodah zarah. Anytime that the Rambam adds on sort of his, you see like a very opinionated words in the Mishnah Torah, we know that he feels very strongly about it, because the Rambam's Mishnah Torah was written literally like with an economist. Every word is very miduyak, and there are occasional spots where the Rambam adds in v'chol hamarbe, right? And all the, those are like clues. I feel very strongly about this. I'm throwing a little bit of my philosophical heavyweight into this halacha, even though typically the Rambam is really, really concise. So that's an interesting aside. V'chol hamevaze hamoadot ki'ilin nitapel ba'avodah zarah. He doesn't want anyone to think that Shabbos, which has kavod in it, right, is higher than Yom Tov. And then the Rambam goes on to say, Shivat Yimei HaPesach U'Shmonat Yimei HaChag Im Shar Yamin Tovim Kulam Asurim BeHesped V'Ta'anit. Okay, it's an interesting halacha. On Yom Tov, you're not allowed to have any Hesped or fasting. So fasting you might appreciate, right, because that is Neged Oneg. Right? Yeah, you certainly cannot be enjoying fasting. Right, so those are counter each other. So you can't, if you have a chiyuv of oneg yom tov, then you can't fast on it. But why not hesped? Okay, and it's actually, unfortunately, something that you hear a lot about. Somebody loses somebody over yantif, and then shiva. Not it's not only hesped; it's also shiva. Shiva is cut short because yom tov cuts shiva, and Shabbos doesn't. Okay, it's an interesting distinction that I think comes from these halachot right here. I'll explain that in a minute. But here the Rambam says, and he gives us the clue as to why this is the case. V'chayiv adam lihiyot bahen sameach v'tov lev. Hu uvana v'ishto uvnei v'eso v'chol hanilvim alav. It's very important. You're not allowed to have tanit or hesped because there is this chiyuv of simcha on Yom Tov, not on Shabbos. There's a chiyuv of oneg on Shabbos, but on Yom Tov it's a chiyuv of simcha. And Sameach Levav, according to the Rambam, it's not just you by yourself. It's not a meditative, contemplative moment. It's about you and your entire household. Banav, Ishto, Bnei Beso, right? It's expansive. And even more than just your own home, L'chol ha'nilvim alav. What's nilvim? Those who depend on you. Those who depend on you. And it could be in so many different fashions, right? It isn't just economics. V'samacht, and it gives a pasuk, V'samacht v'chagecha. Ach al pi. Shahasimcha amura kan hi korban shlamim. If you think it's just an action of bringing a korban shlamim, kmo she'anu mevarim behilchos chagiga, yesh bichlal oto simcha lismoach hu uvanav uvneveso kol echad veechad kara oilo. The Rambam says, don't think it's just about being yotzei zayin by giving money for a korban to be brought in Yerushalayim. It doesn't, you don't just get to check this off by a material transaction. You have an emotive requirement that's much more than just you and your money and where it goes. It's about you and your entire household and all of those who are sort of in your orbit that are expecting some kind of emotional experience. And then the Rambam in Hilchos Yochet, and many people know this. Some people are makbir on it, some people are not makbir on it. How is it that we do this? How do we experience Simchas Yom Tov? The Rambam gives us his recommendation, which is that children get nuts and candies, women get clothing and jewelry, according to your ability, your financial ability, and men are invited to feast on bread and wine because I'm sorry, on meat and wine because ein simcha ela bebasar ve'ein simcha ela beyayin. You might think that that is, for the Rambam, going down a really dangerous road. How could he, the man who's trying to elevate Greek philosophy from being too, let's say, individualistic and isolationist, right? Remember, I brought you Aristotle. There's an entire different school of thought in Greek philosophy, which was the hedonistic school of thought, which was, yes, eat, drink, and be merry, because life is short, right? And the Rambam certainly never valued that, and this sounds very close to that. So the Rambam dedicates the rest of the halacha to say, please, don't read me wrong, right? Don't go overboard. All of that would be more like avodah zarah. So I want to point this out to you. We're just going to skip one line where he's giving the pasuk. Actually, there's no really reason to do that. Okay, there is a reason to do that. We're a little bit short on time. So if you look at the second line of Halacha Yudchet, Ukishahu ochal v'shoteh chayav, if he eats, when he eats and drinks, chayav l'he'echil. He has to also give to others. L'ger li'atom l'amana, im shar ha'aniyim ha'amlalim. As well as any other, amlalim are those that are tragic. Any other tragic poor people. And the Rambam in other places makes it clear that he's not talking about finances. Okay, that means anyone who is depressed, who is in need of support, right? Similar to Kol HaNilvim, everyone in your orbit who could use a little boost. Aval Misha Noel Daltot Chatzro. Anyone who locks the doors of his chatzer, of his yard, house, right, his compound. The ochel v'shoteh hu uvanav v'ishto ve'enu ma'achil u'mashkel aniyim. Someone who gives all the food to his own little kinship circle and doesn't offer it to anybody else. U'lemarei nefesh, he's explicit here, to people who have a bitter heart, who are of need. Ein zu simchat mitzvah, ela simchat kreso. You are not celebrating a mitzvah, you are celebrating your own belly. Right? That's what the Rambam says here. This is his most explicit articulation of what Simcha Mitzvah is by making sure we appreciate what it's not. I may have told you that you need, you know, the accoutrements of Simcha, but it isn't the accoutrements themselves. It's not the candies and the nuts and the jewelry and the clothing, and it's not the wine and the meat. It's the sharing. It's the experience of giving to somebody else. And if what that is a kind word, like what the Rambam says in Matanah Taniyim, and if what that is a seat at your table with whatever crumbs you have, if what that is an open door to your compound so that people in the community know that you're open to them, that's the experience of Simchat Mitzvah here. Don't think it's the $400 roast that gets you off the line. Right? You can have that surely, and if you can, you should include it with everybody else, but that's your check. Is it just for you and your kin, or is this a communal experience? And Yom Tov more than Shabbos. Shabbos perhaps is contemplative. Shabbos perhaps is a person taking their stock in where they are in the creation of Hashem. Yom Tov is communal. Yom Tov must have simcha as a part of it, and simcha must have other people involved. There is no workaround. The Rambam just articulates that further in case anyone thinks that this is an invitation to get drunk and to eat too much. He says, no, that in the second line of Halacha Chet, Eina simcha ela hololus v'sichlut. That's not simcha, right? That's not simcha. Simcha is the invitation to everybody else. Okay, now we go back to why Sefer Devarim has more simcha than any of the other Svarim, because it's at Sefer Devarim that Moshe looks at a community and says, all of you guys together, all of you guys, v'samachta b'chagecha, you're going into Eretz Yisrael, you have the opportunity to build a community on the land and the bracha and to fulfill that bracha. It can only happen b'simcha. And he gives them multiple ways that simcha expresses itself in a community. These are just a few. In Devarim Chaf Daled, he's talking about Shana Rishona. Why is it that a chatan is excluded from serving the community? Because he has to be misameach his kala, and that simcha is the fundamental ability to then become a part of the simcha of the community. In Devarim Yudbet, it's Bikurim again. V'achaltem sham lefnei Hashem Elokecha v'samachta b'chol mishlachetchem atem uveitchem asher b'chart b'erachach Hashem Elokecha. The ability to express and experience simcha must be a shared experience. And once again, on the Yomim Tovim, v'samachta lefnei Hashem Elokecha ata uvincho v'itecha v'avdecha v'amotcha v'halevi asher b'sharecha v'hager v'hayatom v'almana. All people, especially those who may not have their own natural support system, have to be included in our experience of simcha. I'll skip at this moment just to show you, I think it might, because we're going to rush through Kohelet, it might fit best to see this concept coming out of J.D. Salinger's work. Happiness is joy, and happiness is a solid, and joy is a liquid. Think about it this way. This is like Ashreinu Matov Chalkenu versus the Simcha. Simcha is the joy. It bubbles over and it moves. It has to be shared. Simcha is joy shared, whereas happiness might be a private thing, right? You can find yourself happy just like sneaking a glance at somebody else, right, who you have certain satisfaction in seeing what they're doing, right? But simcha, apparently, according to the Rambam and according to the articulation that we've been able to find, cannot be a private moment. It really is. It's a shared joy, and it moves on beyond you. You pass it off, and that's when you get the most out of it. So very, very briefly, I wanted to look at why it is that Kohelet has so many references to Simcha, more than any other Svarim, and the contrast that, I'm sorry that the Psukim here are only in English, I have tremendous Hakar Satov to the staff at Midrashat Yom Rishon. I just give them a list and they just get me all these amazing mikorot. So I would have put these in Hebrew, but for some reason it didn't happen. But anyhow, many people would look at Kohelet and say it's a sefer of despair, not a sefer of happiness, right? A sefer of isolated personal despair, and that what would Kohelet offer to us in terms of understanding happiness? Perhaps only the hedonistic view of like eat, drink, and be merry. In fact, I think that that is very close to what people would read Kohelet and Perek Chet to mean. But I think if we've, without getting into any type of endorsement of articulations, it's just good to know that one opinion is that Moshe was the author of Kohelet. So just to keep that in mind, considering that we just saw Moshe's explicit instructions to Bnei Israel were about Simcha, right? This would be really very different if we read Kohelet as very nihilistic of just eat, drink, and be merry. But again, I'm not endorsing that perspective. I just think it's interesting to keep in mind. An alternate view of Kohelet would be that not despairing of the value of life experiences. It isn't just about the temporary, but because we don't have control over the larger duration of our life, simcha becomes so valuable. Simcha in that fluid, joyous sharing. When you really embrace the power of simcha to be as inclusive as it has its articulation within Simchas Yom Tov, within the Simcha of a Chasan and a Kala, within the Simcha of sharing everything that we have with anyone who might need, right? Perhaps the Simcha that Kohelet refers to is his antidote. Everything else I have no control over. But whatever I have the ability to share. And if I share it, guess what happens? It goes way beyond me. Right? And if I share it, it has the capacity to live. I'm almost like tricking mortality. I have grappled with mortality. That's Kohelet. my time here, I don't know about. The justice of my life here, I don't know about. I face it. I know that I don't have control over those big matters. But what do I have control over? Everything that I have. And I therefore will take it and share it. I think there are times that the simcha that Kohelet mentions might be despairing, but I think when you think about the word simcha, as it's used both in halacha and in Tanakh, you cannot ignore that perhaps Kohelet is aware of that and offering us an antidote to the very depressing realities that he's facing. I don't have answers to the other things, but I have the capacity to reevaluate that happiness lives longer than just the immediate experience. So I kind of like to look at Kohelet's psukim with that in mind and imagine that he wasn't, because otherwise the turnaround that Kohelet experiences at the end is very hard. All of a sudden he believes in God, right? But to imagine that all along he's struggling with the big questions I don't have answers to, but the little experiences of my interactions and of what it is, sharing what it is that I have with everybody around me, I have control of that, and that has the capacity to offer goodness to other people well beyond my own limitations. So those are the psukim that I offered you here, and I apologize that we don't have the time to go further into each one of them. Thank you very much for coming. I'm happy to take any questions if you have. Yes. So no, Rabbi Nid Henkin's commentary to everybody was, what you need to do on Simchas Torah is to take the Sefer Torah and to take each other. She says there should be no private pain on Simchas Torah. I'm sorry. She says she was endorsing, yeah, at the Shiva. People came to her at Shiva and said, what are we supposed to do? She says, you go and you dance. And Simchas Yom Tov requires the unity of all of us with each other and with the Sefer Torah. So I think Simchas Torah specifically extends in that way of us feeling united and appreciating. It was extraordinary. To hear that comment to me was really extraordinary, very unbelievable. And it's hard in face. It's almost like what she was saying, it's a defiance. It's like a dance of rebellion, right? Thank you.